Yatha, as he certainly, Purusha, a man, Bharam, a burden, Shirasa, on the head, Kurum, heavy, Utvaham, carrying, Tam, that, Skandhena, on the shoulder, Saha, he, Adhati, puts, Tatha, similarly, Sarvaha, all, Pratikriya, counteraction. Translation. A man may carry a burden on his head, and when he feels it to be too heavy, he sometimes gives relief to his head by putting the burden on his shoulder. Is this loud enough? In this way he tries to relieve himself of the burden. However, whatever process he devises to counteract the burden, the burden does nothing more than put the same burden from one place to another. I repeat. However, whatever process he devises to counteract the burden does nothing more than put the same burden from one place to another. Purport by Divine Grace, Srila Prabhupada. This is a good description of an attempt to transfer a burden from one place to another. When one gets tired of keeping a burden on his head, he will place it on his shoulder. This does not mean that he has become free from the strains of carrying the burden. Similarly, human society, in the name of civilization, is creating one kind of trouble to avoid another kind of trouble. In contemporary civilization, we see that there are many automobiles manufactured to carry us swiftly from one place to another. But at the same time, we have created other problems. We have to construct so many roads, and yet these roads are insufficient to cope with automobile congestion and traffic jams. There are also the problems of air pollution and fuel shortage. The conclusion is that the process of manufacture, the processes we manufacture to counteract or minimize our distresses do not actually put an end to our pains. It is all simply illusion. We simply place the burden from the head to the shoulder. The only real way we can minimize our problems is to surrender unto the Supreme Personality of Godhead and give ourselves up to His protection. The Lord, being all-powerful, can make arrangements to mitigate our painful life in material existence. Omagyanatimirandasya gyananjana shalakaya chakshurun militam jena tasmai Sri Gurave Namaha. Here, Sri Narada Muni continues his instruction to King Prachina Parishad. In the wake of telling the story of King Puranjana, who was actually a fictitious character, Narada Muni used to make it easier for the listener. Just like Prabhupada used to say that if you want to teach the friend of your daughter how to behave when she is visiting or staying over, you instruct your daughter, and by instructing your daughter, even though the daughter already knows, she's already heard it, no harm hearing it again, but actually the friend will listen and say, I better do this, I better do that, I better stay in line. It's much easier than if you try to instruct the friend herself. She may get hurt, she may take it the wrong way, that who are you, you're not my mother. But if you instruct your daughter, then the friend is more likely to hear the instruction. In the same way, although in Srimad Bhagavatam, we are told that the stories are real stories, histories. They actually happened. Prabhupada says that when Srimad Bhagavatam mentions that the story is not real, the story is not real, Vyasadeva will mention that. He will say, this is not a true story. This is fictitious. This is the case in the as far as the story of King Puranjana is concerned. Puranjana actually means, what does Puranjana mean, anyone knows? Yes, the conditioned living entity, the conditioned soul. And so in this chapter, coming after the story itself, Narada Muni explains the different, he reveals to King Parikshita Nabari the explanation to the different facets of the story. For example, that the city of nine gates mean the body, the material body, with nine holes, so like nine gates. And he describes the ten senses, perception and working senses, the mind, so as to make sure that the story itself has been understood. Just like you can see in Krishna book, Srila Prabhupada talks about all these demons that Krishna killed, but he does not reveal what these demons correspond to. And I used to think, but you know, what's the use if we're told about all these demons, we're supposed to think that they are real? But surely there must be some, they must represent something symbolically. And sure enough, down the line I found out that Bhaktivinoda Thakur has given a symbolic meaning to each demon, what they represent, which is also very important. But in the beginning it is not necessary, therefore Srila Prabhupada did not he wrote the Krishna book in a very succinct way to summarize the 10th canto, because he thought that he may not live long enough to translate the Srimad Bhagavatam. So it is packed with philosophy, and the stories are just told very simply. Then after one has read the Krishna book, can read the Srimad Bhagavatam, and eventually understand what these demons are all about, especially by reading Bhaktivinoda Thakur's books. They are very important, but they are very advanced, and so not necessarily desirable for beginners in Krishna consciousness to read Srila Bhaktivinoda Thakur's writings. They are very advanced. If one comes across the Sri Krishna Sanghita, for example, it can be very bewildering what Bhaktivinoda Thakur says in there to the neophyte. Even you know, still today, books like the Sri Krishna Sanghita are to be discussed among devotees to know really what Bhaktivinoda Thakur is trying to say. Now, when I first read this verse here, it brought to mind, you know, shifting a load, a burden, a responsibility from one arm to another, from the head down to, you know, the back. But there is no ultimate relief so long as one carries the burden. Only by putting it down, actual relief will occur. Otherwise, temporary relief may be there, you know, when you carry something on one arm, and it makes sense to put it on the other. Until you reach the destination, it can be helpful. But ultimately, the burden will be put down. Otherwise, there's only so long one can carry the burden. And if you run out of steam before the destination, then in any case, that burden will be dropped, because there will be no energy left. So in the same way, sooner or later, the Puranjana, the conditioned soul, will have to put the burden down. But either he will do it being forced, you know, like at the time of death it says, there are five stages. Harisari Prabhu was saying in Mayapur, when some devotee was passing away. There are five known stages before one actually surrenders to death. And so the surrender part, even for regular people, this is usual for at least good people, people who are pious enough. The last stage will be that I have tried everything. I've eaten, I've tried to medication, I've tried to believe that I'm not dying, that I will somehow or other live, and that I will get better. And then there is the stage where you realize that you're not going to get better. In fact, you're going to get very much worse before you get better. And that you may only get better after death. So, there is a stage where the soul actually gives up fighting and surrenders to death. Krishna says, for the atheists or for the non-believers, I am death. I come in the form of death. And so, the majority of people will come to the stage of surrendering to the Lord in the form of death. And this has been studied by psychologists who study the process of dying. That there is a stage where everything has been tried and the soul just simply gives up fighting and stops eating or goes into a coma. This is the form of surrender of the conditioned soul who is not who has not been able to surrender before death. But as we know, the advice is given to drop the burden before we are forced to do so. So this verse gives a graphic description of how, so long as we keep the burden, there is no relief. And that relief which we experience is only temporary. So, sarvada man parityaja mamikam saranam braja aham tam sarva padevyo moksha ishami masudaham. That all these religions, all these dharma, all these activities, these beliefs that we hang on to believe this or that, to keep us alive, to carry on living, Krishna says just give them all up. And surrender unto me means to drop all of them, and simply depend on me. Manmana bhavamat bhakto madhyajimam namaskuru. The verse before, that is the verse just before Sarva Dharma Parijaja in the 18th chapter, and that verse is repeated twice, it appears also in the 9th chapter. Always think of me, manmana, bhava, become madhvarto, become my devotee, always think of me. That is surrender, like that. And by doing that, don't worry, I take care of everything. I take care of all your karma. All of your karma I will take care of. When Krishna says, sarvadaman parityaja, does he mean, oh, you have to give up being a Christian, you have to give up being a Muslim, you have to give up being an atheist, you have to give up being a humanitarian, you have to give up being a jnani? Is this what he means? Actually, this is not really what it means. The religion that we are talking about is anything other than love of God. But Srila Prabhupada does mention that, in other words, when Srila Prabhupada was preaching to the general public, he wasn't saying give up your religion and join ours. Did you hear Prabhupada ever suggest that you have to give up your religion and join us? Srila Prabhupada would encourage people to practice their religion. And in fact, most of his disciples, his followers, are people who used not to follow religion. They used to especially come from the Christian background. But they were not the people who were practicing Christianity. We are all people who were not practicing, who were born into it, who got some catechism, some religious education, who dropped out of that, and who became very frustrated and dissatisfied. And only by meeting Srila Prabhupada, we had it was a new package, so we got excited by the exotic package and side to it, maybe, and to other things. Maybe it was also more complete. We know that. But basically, we had dropped the attempt. We had dropped the real thing. We had dropped the attempt to love God. So, religion, giving up religion does not mean other religions. It means the religion of the heart. Love of God, which is available in every religion, if one is serious enough, and if one is lucky enough to find a bona fide spiritual master within that line. So, there's no point for us to try and put other religions down, that they are not offering the real religion. The real religion is to be had anywhere in the world. So long as one is able to focus to separate the hay from the shaft. What is love of God? Love of God is the religion. It is mahamana bhava matbhakto, to become a devotee of the Lord. Now, sometimes, religion, what actually is the kind of religion is to be given up. I remember in Paris, once, I lived in Paris, and I went to this shop. It was a hardware store merchant. And I became very impressed by the man, because he was so honest. First, I made a mistake, I gave him too much, and he brought to my attention that, oh no, no, you're giving me too much here. And so I complimented him and said, thank you very much, you're a very honest man. And then he gave me a whole lecture about being honest, about truth. So I was very happy to hear it, but whenever I tried to go a little further, making truth, you know, the Lord's truth, the eternal truth, the man had no... He had no interest, he had no capacity to grasp what I was talking about. His level of understanding, God for him, was truth, to be truthful, to be honest. If people could just be honest, I'm showing the example of being honest, and this is my mission in life, very good. But that's a kind of religion. It's not in itself spiritual. It is in the mode of goodness. But this is the kind of religion that one that has to be given up. Even Yudhishthira Maharaj, who was like that, absolutely truthful, eventually Krishna put him to the test. That, you know, you've got to say that Ashwatthama is dead. You've got to say it. But it's not true. Well, it's not true, okay, it's not true, but you've got to say it. In fact, it is true. Ashwatthama, the elephant, is dead. So like that, some trickery is there, even though it's true and it's not true. So sometimes devotees stretch the truth a little bit, and we can be criticized for that. We can also be wrong for stretching the truth when it doesn't have to be. Stretching the truth, or in other words, lying for the good cause, you know. So if we stretch it too often or too much, then it's like milk diluted with water, you know, there's a point where it's no longer milk. So in the same way, we have to be careful about this principle of stretching the truth and of considering truth or morality to be a sub-religious principle, and therefore doing away with it, that, oh, we don't really have to be moral. Very, very slippery road. We need to be very careful. However, it is the kind of religion that has to be given up for the sake of the Lord. If there is any time where we need to make a decision and stretch the truth for the sake of service, then it has to be done. Another example is Mahatma Gandhi, who preached non-violence. Of course, ahimsa is definitely a very important religious tenet, so important that the Buddha avatar made it the center of his preaching, because at the time people were using killing animals in the name of Vedic sacrifices. Therefore, he banned the idea of killing animals for any reason, and he preached non-violence. But this non-violence is also somewhere you can get stuck in, just like Mahatma Gandhi. Even though he was praising Bhagavad Gita as his book, you know, his staple book, the book of his life, the book he referred to, that whenever he endured tragedy in his life, he would consult the Bhagavad Gita. And even by reading one shloka, the greatest best despair and happiness would go away. But Mahatma Gandhi, with all his appreciation of Bhagavad Gita, interpreted it. Somehow or other, even though it is happening on a battlefield, where people, millions of people are killed, somehow or other Mahatma Gandhi managed to construe it to be the Bible of non-violence and pacifism. And he, of course, had to say that, oh, this Bhagavad Gita, Bhaktivinoda Kurukshetra, never actually happened. It is not a historical event, but it is a symbolic event to mean the fight that is actually going on inside. But the battle of Kurukshetra is happening inside of us. The five Pandavas are the five senses, etc. So in that, you know, there is some speculation, but there is also truth that we shouldn't think Bhagavad Gita and Srimad Bhagavad, especially the battle of Kurukshetra, was only a historical event. It is also an event that is going on inside, in our lives. The battle of Kurukshetra is going on. There is Duryodhana inside. The archetype of Duryodhana is there inside. So when we hear about Duryodhana, we say, oh, how horrible. How can someone be so demoniac? And Shakuni, these people are inconceivably demoniac. How is this possible? I mean, even though I'm sinful, I could never be so bad. But actually we don't realize, and we miss the point that these characters are inside of us. Arjuna is also there, inside of us. And this Arjuna is trying to hear the Bhagavad Gita. We are trying to hear the Bhagavad Gita and to remember it and to fight for Krishna, remembering Krishna. Always remembering. But it's not easy. Why? Because the fight is going on. And because Duryodhana is doing his job, and there is also Dhritarashtra. Oh, Dhritarashtra is ever so powerful. How many times do I not hear devotees say, oh well, Prabhu, you know, that's the way it is. Actually, Krishna made me do it. Or I think Krishna wants me to go and have some Mahaprasad right now. It didn't work out because it wasn't meant to be. This is the Dhritarashtra in us. We've got to be very careful. We've got to stay with the Pandavas and listen to Krishna and let Krishna ride our chariot by surrendering to him. He will take us to the right places, and all we have to do is shoot the arrows. Another aspect of religion is in Bhagavad Gita, described in the 6 first chapters, in terms of karma yoga, jnana yoga, Ashtanga Yoga. These yogas, Jayadvaita Maharaj was explaining in the Bhakti Shastri course in Mayapur, that what is a Jnana Yogi? You know, sometimes we are not quite clear what is a Jnana Yogi, because we also do Jnana. And Karma Yogi, but we also do Karma Yoga. So what is the difference between us and a Jnana Yogi or a Karma Yogi? Can someone say? What is the difference between them and us? We're also doing these yogas. In fact, some of us are also doing hatha yoga, asanas, pranayama. The difference is, yes,
Prabhu? As a matter of fact, apparently, Nama Krishna Goswami said that up to the point that Prabhupada was not wanted, we were practicing bhakti yoga, but after that, there is a significant shift towards karma yoga. So, in other words, Bhakti Yoga is obviously performing the activities, giving the activity itself already to Krishna, whereas Karma Yoga is giving the results after the activity has been performed.
Yes, that's very good. What Jayadvaita Swami said, which really makes sense to me, is that a Jnana Yogi is someone who studies the Vedas to know he is a Brahmin. And he studies in order to know, because he understands that knowledge is the key to liberation. And he doesn't go any further. He remains on that platform. And because he remains on that platform and doesn't go further as Krishna instructs in Bhagavad Gita towards Bhakti Yoga, he is called a Jnana Yogi. He remains a Jnana Yogi and he dies a Jnana Yogi. That makes him a Jnana Yogi. Someone who performs Karma Yoga for the same purpose, more or less, he gives up the result of his activities to the Lord or to whoever is representing the Lord. And he never comes up to the platform of devotion. He just does it as a matter of duty, because Krishna says, you know, in the third chapter, fifth chapter, act as a matter of duty. This is, he insists very much on duty, duty, duty. So a karma yogi is someone who lives out of duty. And he acts in order to free himself from bondage and become liberated, but not to become, you know, manmana bhavana bhakto and always think of Krishna. That is the karma yogi. And the same with the hatha yogis in the modern age. What do they do? Karma. What do? Their asanas for? At best, they do it for health. But they don't even do it for transcendental progression. They don't do it to acquire mystic powers. They do it for a very base reason. So they can barely be called hatha yogis. There is no doubt that the potential is there in those yogas to achieve transcendence, but not and bhakti yoga also. But if one remains stuck on one of these levels, then he is a jnana yoga, jnana yogi, karma yogi, whatever yogi. And ultimately, Krishna says in the end of the sixth chapter, after describing very technically the process of mystic yoga through sitting and meditation, that's jnana yoga. That yoginam api sarvesham madhyatenam taratmana shalhava bhajate yomam sami yukta tamomataha. Of all the yogis, yoginam api sarvesham madhyatenam. There again, always think of me, same thing. Is one who always thinks of him. That is the biggest, the greatest yogi. Machita magyata prana, machita thoughts. The thoughts of my devotees always dwell in me. So Krishna repeats again and again, there is no excuse for anyone to remain on any platform like jnana yoga or karma yoga. There is no excuse whatsoever. In India, when you try to distribute the Bhagavad Gita, people say, oh, Bhagavad Gita, yes, yes, I know. I say, okay, well, so what is the message of Bhagavad Gita, sir? Please tell me, let me know, I would like to know. And usually the verse that they quote is, what is that? You have a right to perform your duty, but you are not entitled to the fruits of your action. Yakyan. Karamadhyaya vani karasya na mapalishu. Kadachana, mapalishu, but the fruits doesn't belong to you. Matkarma, bana, iturbur, matisango na karmani. That's their understanding. Somehow or other, even though Krishna is so clear and repeats 100 times that to think of him is the goal of his Gita, of his song, somehow or other, people manage to get stuck in some level, like doing your duty. And usually their excuse, their deep down, the desire is that if I do with my duty, I will enjoy. I will be able to enjoy. Even if I give up the results to Krishna, still I will enjoy. And, this is my duty, that's what I have to do. Maybe after my death I will go to heaven and enjoy unlimitedly. So, sarva upadhi vinyur muktam. Mat paratena nirmanam. Rishikena rishikesha sivanam bhakti uruchate. To become free from designation. These religions are designations. And to always think of Krishna, that is the only way to get free from these designations. While we do this karma yoga, while we study the text, while we do our mystic meditation, which is japa and the morning program, that we do it to please the Lord, the senses of the Lord. Rishikena Rishikesha. That we do the same thing as other people are doing, or as the other religionists and the yogis and the karmis are doing. But do we do it to please the Lord? And we are not sannyasis, we are not grihasthas, we are not brahmacharis, naham vipro, na chala, narabati, na vivaisho, na shudro. We are gopi bhaktu, padakamalayo, das, das, anu, das. We are servant of God, not even. Das, das, anu, dasa. We are servant of the servant, of the servant. Of those who are free from sarva upadi, of all designation. That is what we are. Servant of the servant. Then we can please the Lord. Then the Lord is pleased. I was meditating the other day on one beautiful vision I had. That this process of surrender through, you know, the different juggling with burdens, taking on burdens. Actually, after surrendering, the idea is that we don't just surrender and that's it. That's liberation, impersonal liberation. We surrender and then we remain surrendered and we enjoy transcendental bliss. But devotees are not interested in this kind of surrender. After surrender, just like Lord Krishna said to Arjuna, surrender, abandon all varieties of religion and surrender. Arjuna had to pick up his bow and fight. So I was thinking, when we wake up in the morning, the first thing that happens, every one of us, every day of our lives, when we wake up in the morning, what happens is that we shift from complete ignorance, sleep, to semi-consciousness, that we wake up to, that was just a dream. And, oh, that's reality, yeah. Oh, God, let me go to the bathroom. And then I go to the bathroom and splash water on our face. At least I do that. And when I do that, then I take the towel and dry my face with, you know, a little massage. And then suddenly I'm awake. I go from semi-consciousness to consciousness. And then they say, it's not enough. Okay, brush teeth. You know, as soon as you brush your teeth, it's like you're one step further to wake the wake stage. You feel like, okay, now I'm starting to feel all right. So then after that, you go to the toilet and you evacuate. That means you get rid of all the rubbish. It's a bit like surrendering. You give up. You give up the rubbish. You give up the stool, the contamination. Then after doing that, well, you purify yourself. You go in the shower and you should purify your whole body. So in this, so symbolically identical to spiritual life. After shower, what do? We come out, we dry ourselves, we put tilak on, that this body is the temple, is the Lord's temple. Like that. This is to remind us that this is not my body, this is Krishna's body. So here, you know, Om Keshavaya Namaha, Narayanam Namaskarita, what is it? Lalate Keshavandhyayan Narayanam Atodare, Lakshas Venus, Lakshas Tate, what? Madhavam Tugovindakupake, etc. To remind us that this body, I am not the body, this body is the instrument entrusted to me by the Lord. And He resides in this body. The Lord is inside. It's His temple. And after doing this, we dress the temple. It's like decorating the temple. When we dress ourselves in Vaishnava clothes. So this is all religious practice. This is all part of sadhana. There is no action that is separate anymore. Everything is to please the Lord. Rishikena, Rishikesha. And so once we address, what do? We walk to the temple. That's what devotees do. They use their feet to walk to the temple. So then, when we walk to the temple, we meditate on the Lord. Say, I'm going to take darshan now. You see all the thinking. Everything is focused by the grace of Sri Guru, Srila Prabhupada. He gave us the process. All we have to do it is mechanically, whatever, however we can. But to do it every day, day in and day out, that's all we have to do, go through the motions. Then we go to the temple, and once we enter the temple, and then what do we do once we enter the temple? We bow down. And you know, I don't know about you, but I'm 52 and my body's starting to ache a little. Even in the morning, when I walk to the temple in Mayapur, it's like half a mile, half a kilometer. And when I get to the temple, and I've dandavat in front of the Lord, I feel like this. Whew. Suddenly, you're like it, experiencing relief from the burden of so many efforts. Now, of course, the effort is for Krishna, but, you know, it's not easy. To get up is not easy. And in all this business of showering, and it's like, okay, you get it out of the way, and you go to the real business in the temple. But even chanting japa, nothing's easy. However, you may have noticed that when you go down, it's like suddenly you don't have to do anything. It's like sleeping, but you know, you're surrendering to the Lord. That's real surrender. So symbolically speaking, this dandavat pranam is surrender. And all this, if we keep doing it, mechanically, whatever way, if we keep doing it, no doubt, it will yield the desired result, which is actual surrender, atmanivedam, surrender of the soul. Now, in the purport here, Srila Prabhupada mentions two, as far as I can tell, two interesting points, probably more, but two prominent points here, is the idea of doing something about the miseries by finding a solution to the problems, to the miseries. If we try to do that by manufacturing a problem, such as manufacturing automobiles, to move faster, and then we need to build roads, like Srila Prabhupada says, and then we need to deal with congestion and traffic, we create new problems. Whereas if we surrender to the process of the Lord, in other words, if we surrender to nature, the laws of nature, instead of creating cars, there's other ways of moving around. In fact, yogis could travel by the speed of mind, much faster than cars or rockets. If we cure ourselves, if we treat our bodies with Ayurveda, then again, that is the natural way. There is always a natural way. We have a choice between the natural way or the man-made way. And it is obvious that the natural way does not create problems. There are actually solutions. All these herbs in nature, each and every herb corresponds to an illness that they can cure, if only we have the knowledge to do it. And if we have not only the knowledge, but if we agree to go through the process, Ayurveda is a little slower in curing diseases, but it's very effective. Although the problem is nowadays that just like there is only one chapter of Brahma Samhita still remaining, there is very little of Ayurveda still remaining. So the naturopathic ways of curing diseases is tempered with, and therefore, for the sake of preaching, for the sake of expediency, we often resort to things like cars and Western medicine. So how do we explain this? People can point a finger to us and say, well, you guys are not doing what you preach, because you're also using cars and using those things that you condemn. So to this, of course, we've got the principle of Yukta Vairagya, because as long as we are not using these things for ourselves, like this Prabhu, Padmanitra Prabhu, he has a car, but he uses it very seldom, only when he has the need for it. And some other devotees, they have a car, but they don't use it anymore for the sake of, shopping around or sightseeing. So long as we use whatever we've been given for the Lord, let there be reactions that, okay, if it creates problems in our lives, but if it is the instruction of the spiritual master that we must use this or use that for the sake of preaching, then, like the gopis, in the spirit of the gopis, let reactions come my way. If I have to die of cancer, or I'm just going to give my best while I can, and then that's another kind of surrender, that we are prepared to take the reactions in case we do something not quite natural, if we use things in the framework of Yukta Vairagya, then we take a risk. And we have faith that Krishna will pick us up. He will not be punished for it. And even if we are punished, let us be punished, like the gopis. They were prepared to go to hell for the sake of relieving Krishna's headache. So here we know Srila Prabhupada has taken a very big headache coming out to the West and preaching this mission, which was mission impossible. And he did it at the time when he had every reason to stay in Vrindavan and just go back to Godhead. We cannot begin to imagine what Prabhupada has done, but that's another topic. What we can do is pick up the burden after we have shed the burden that is talked about in this verse, is to pick up another burden, the burden of juggling with, like weights, with the different aspects of spreading this mission. Very big burden, going out on book distribution, doing administration. Oh my God, sorry.
Burden of love, this is called sometimes. Burden of love.
The burden of love. Yes, so this is a burden of love. Just like sometimes we need to stretch the truth, not too far, we also need to take on the burden, not too much, just what we can. Let us not try to do too much. Let us not stretch ourselves too much. Because Prabhupada was not interested in shooting stars. Prabhupada was interested in steady disciples. Steady shooting stars are the disciples who come and go. They may do a lot for a year or two, go out of distribution, hundreds of books, and then finished. And how many of them are still out there? Somehow or other, they have had their 10 years or 20 years in the movement. And that's it. The rest of their lives is no more for some whatever mysterious reason. I also sometimes wonder, how can they? But, you know, somehow or other they can. So, let us not risk that and do just what we can. Not too much, but also not too little. Let us not be afraid to take up the banner and do what we can while we can. Pick up the burden instead of just remaining free of burden. Like this verse would suggest that, you know, don't just drop the burden and that's all. Krishna says in Bhagavad Gita, I'll just end with this, that these are the regulative principles of freedom, of real freedom. Real freedom means regulative principles. Real freedom means many regulations. If you look into what anarchy they are, in the spiritual world is anarchy. There's no need for a government. Everybody is spontaneously behaving because they are following all the rules spontaneously. It's second nature. So when someone is absolutely well behaved, there is no more need for rules and regulations. This is freedom. And sadhana means regulations, regulative principles that will give us real freedom. That even if though we may carry a very heavy burden, it doesn't weigh anything. It doesn't weigh anything anymore. Thank you very much. Is there any quick question or comment? Another question is, there was violence, but not as much as today. And so, is it that, why did Lord Buddha appear then and not now? Well, actually, the Lord appeared in the form of Srila Prabhupada, Lord Chaitanya. The Lord will always appear. He is here now in the form of us, somehow or other. We need to represent the Lord. So the Lord is here through us. We are the Lord. In fact, in the previous chapter, Narada was telling that, the Lord himself was saying that. The super soul, the same to the soul. There is no difference between you and. And Prabhupada says, translates qualitative difference. But the Sanskrit doesn't even say qualitative. But it's understood. Krishna, Prabhupada makes it clear that it's qualitative. But qualitatively, we are God. We are the Lord. Like that. So we need to be ourselves and represent ourselves, which is part and parcel of the Supreme. When Buddha appeared, certainly, yes, there was less violence, But the violence was in the name of religion. So therefore Buddha came to say, oh, forget about the Vedas. Forget about religion. And just follow me. So he's God. They followed him. It was a trick. You know, they became Buddhists, followers of Lord Buddha. They followed the Lord, like Krishna says in Bhagavad Gita. Everyone follows my path in all respects. But nowadays people don't eat meat or kill animals for the sake of religion anyway. Not even that. They just eat meat for sense gratification and nothing else. They consider that there is no soul in animals, which is pretty handy when you want to eat flesh. All you have to do is declare that there is no soul in the animal, and the next thing is that there is no soul in a human being either. And eventually, at the end of Kali Yuga, people will kill each other and eat each other. That's ultimately where it goes to.
Another question was about, you said at some point, don't need to give up your religion and Muslims, and you also mentioned atheism.
Yes, religion, football, eating, atheism, these are all religions.
And you said you don't need to give up.
Yes, that's right. People sometimes they ask me, you remember we were at this program last Sunday, and I said that people think I have given up my faith of birth, that I rejected Christ. This is the great accusation. You have rejected Jesus Christ. Maybe some devotees have. I mean, some devotees have a very bad taste from their former lives, and they don't want to hear about Jesus or Christianity. But it's not my case. For me, if I'm here, it's because of Jesus Christ. So I tell them that I never had to give up anything. In fact, when I became a devotee, I started to become a real Christian because I followed the teachings of Jesus. And I'm sure that he must be more happy with me now than he was before. So you don't need to give up real religion. Whatever shape your real religion was in the past, don't give that up. Just increase it. So we should not be confused about that. What is meant by religion is atheism as much as anything else. Some trick, some manufactured purpose or belief in life, that I don't want God in my life. I want that my religion is to do good, because this guy upstairs is not doing anything about it, and we're suffering like hell here. He's not going to help. I'm going to help. I'm going to be God. I'm going to be the good guy. And behind humanitarianism there is some of that, you know. He's not doing his job, so I'm going to do it for him, and people will worship me. Yes, I know I'm good, yes. It's my nature. It's my nature. I'm just trying to help you out. Anything else? Yes, ma'am.
Just thinking about why Buddha doesn't come out. Because I think Lord Chaitanya is the foremost for me. It's not just making people come right, it's
also being in the world. It's much more necessary. Yes. Lord Chaitanya is the is the accumulation of all incarnations. He is Mahabhadanyaya, the most magnanimous avatar. He is all of them combined. Including Buddha, of course. Yes.
Yeah, just thought of comment on the same thing. As thinking that after 10,000 years, then George Chaitanya's movement may not be there, the devotees may not be there, and then no one comes. But I was also thinking that this is Kali Yuga, and Krishna also needs to give time for certain souls who want to do bad things to allow them to do bad things. In other words, this is the age for souls who want to be simple and have these very deep desires come.
This is the call of the last minute. You know, Lord Chaitanya is ringing the bell. Last call, 10,000 years. And then after 10,000 years, sorry, you're out of luck. Just wait for Kalki Avatar. No, really. Yes, probably.
I saw it from Harina Chitam, a friend of mine. He said, if you have a first name like Krishna or Indra, you have a secondary name like Paramatma, Father,
Krishna.
Krishna said, he always said, Father from Creator. He put into the book, he said, who changed holy name, but by Krishna or Indra, who Gauka Vindam, who changed this secondary name, maybe go by Kunta or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
Just this name.
These are details. You know, whether we go to Narayan or we go to Krishna, these are details. The differences between the names. For us, it is not so relevant as what we are talking about. We've got so much to work on before we make distinctions between how many times Lord Vishnu is one name of Lord Krishna. Okay. It's nice to know it, and devotees get busy with that, but it's not really the main thing. For us, it's not so important. What is important is bhakti. Bhakti to the Lord, whether it is to Narayan or to Krishna, it's bhakti. Bhakti to the Lord, there is Narayan is Krishna. Krishna is Narayan. Bhakti is for the Lord in whatever form, shape and form he is. Even if he doesn't have a form, if someone has bhakti and think he doesn't conceive of the form of the Lord, still, he gets the same benefit that devotion gives. Because you can come for darshan every day. You can have a full understanding of Krishna's form, but you may not be able to develop very much bhakti. Some people see the Lord and if they're working in the temple, but not devotees. You may have the Lord in front of you and not see Him. You may not see the Lord. He may be in front of you. Prabhupada was seen by so many people. They couldn't see Him. They couldn't see His position, His real grandeur. So Krishna, people may see pictures of Krishna and they may appreciate something. But the main thing is bhakti. Even if there is no, it's like when we chant japa, do we see Krishna? No, we're in the dark, we're trying. We're trying, and one day we may see. But for the time being, it doesn't matter so much. So, the differences between the power of the names, these are secondary, like it says, secondary names. But actually the whole topic is secondary. If we focus too much, then we are like fanatics, that my religion is better than yours. That's the mentality. If we get too much, then we also become stuck, like the Jnana yogis. We become stuck in the idea of being better than others. And Bhaktivinoda Thakur covers this. Bhaktivinoda Thakur says that to think ourselves to be Vaishnavas, and you're Christian and you're Muslim, is the bodily concept. It is Sava Upadi, it is an Upadi, it is a designation. We are not these kind of Vaishnavas with Jilak. That's temporary also. We are more than that. We're Gopi Bhattu Padagamalaya. That's what we are. It's Vaishnavas, Gaudiya Vaishnav, or another kind of Vaishnav. These are temporary designations. So then you say, oh, we are going to Goloka, but the Sri Vaishnavas are going somewhere else, and the other Vaishnavas are going somewhere else. So we don't really need this. I'm not blaming you. But
my point is, for example, you like because every person individual, I don't say better, because every person individual, because you're working with people, also both in different
relationships. Yeah, better, or even, the idea that, being a shakha is not enough. I want to be a manjari. Or, coward boy. Who wants to be a coward boy? At least I've got to be a manjari. See, we can get sidetracked with this kind of considerations when it's premature. Right now, we just forget about it and just serve. Follow the instructions and the services that we are given. We won't have too much energy to spend just there. And forget about the fanatical aspects of becoming greater and having other people be smaller. So I'm just giving this answer probably because it's in the mood of my lecture I had a theme to follow. Otherwise, in a different context, I would probably say something else. Grandhara Srimad Bhagavatam ki, Srila Prabhupada ki.